If you're looking for a podcast to give you home remedies that will help with springtime allergies.
Oh my gosh. If you find that podcast, please frickin' let us know.
Because this is not that podcast.
No, it's not. And I've got snot, so I need help. It's like, what the heck and heck? Anyway,
thank you for sharing. This is, however, comedy.
Tragedy.
Marriage. Welcome to Comedy Tragedy Marriage, podcast where a longtime married couple takes turns each episode selecting a movie, TV show, or documentary to watch. We watch it together, then we sit down and discuss why we liked it, loved it, or loathed it, and share that discussion with you. I am Stan the Movie Man. On occasion, I review films at stanthemovieman.com. You can follow me on Twitter at MovieManStan. You can follow the podcast at CT Marriage. You can also follow me on such places as Spoutable, as well as Blue Sky and Threads at Stan the Movie Man. If you have a question or a suggestion for something for us to watch and talk about on the podcast, you can send that to us via email, comedytragedymarriage@gmail.com. And you can also send us a voice message simply by clicking the link in the description of this episode. Joining me, as always, is my other half.
Maud, the wintry, bony, heckin' allergic broad.
Yes. It was my choice this week as to what to watch, and because of the Academy Awards, I decided it brought this movie to mind. Not because this film was nominated, because this film is 14 years old, and not because the actress who leads it was nominated this year, but she did get an Academy Award nomination starring in this film back in 2010. That is Jennifer Lawrence. Her first Academy Award nomination was for this movie, and it is Winter's Bone.
That's why I'm the wintry bony broad.
Yes. The film also stars John Hawkes, Kevin Bresnahan, Dale Dickey, Garrett Delahunt, Cheryl Lee, Tate Taylor, and more. It is a story of a 17-year-old girl named Ree Dolly, played by Jennifer Lawrence. She is in a very desperate situation. Her mother is mentally ill. Apparently has had some sort of emotional breakdown.
Something.
And she is uncommunicative and just sort of sits and stares.
Basically catatonic.
Yes. She reacts to things some, but she does not participate in communication. She doesn't talk with her children. She doesn't, do any housework or anything like that. The family lives in the Ozarks, and they are desperately poor. Ree has a younger brother, a 12-year-old brother named Sonny, and a 6-year-old sister named Ashley. Now, their father is out of the picture. Now, he's out of the picture because he is in and out of jail because he cooks drugs. He cooks what's called crank, which is a version of methamphetamine, which in the part of the Ozarks they are in is common. A lot of people do that. He is due to be in court in a few days. And the Sheriff Baskin, played by Garrett Dillahunt, comes to the house looking for Jessup, and informs Ree that if Dad doesn't show up for his court hearing, they're going to lose their house and property because Dad put up the house and land for his bond to get out. And that will leave them homeless. They have nothing else except the house and the land.
Yeah,
so
the land.
Her and the two kids and her mom will have nothing.
And no place to be.
And the bail bondsman actually shows up because Jessup doesn't show up for his court hearing. And tells them they have about a week, and that the land and the house doesn't really even cover his bond. But somebody showed up with a big fat stack of cash that covered the difference. Had no idea who it was, and he wasn't the type to sign his name. Now, the people that Jessup was dealing with could best be described as a redneck mafia, kind of a cross between The Sopranos and Deliverance. It's a very tight-knit and tight-lipped group of rednecks who run the local drug trade. And people that ask too many questions either get beat up real bad or just flat disappear. But Ree's got to find her dad in order to either turn him back into the cops or prove he's dead, if that's what's happened.
Yeah, either so that, him or evidence of him.
Yeah. You know, so that they don't lose their home. And these people that she's dealing with do not want her asking questions about their business, about what happened to Jessup. Did anything happen to Jessup? She is told over and over and over again that she needs to leave it be. But that does not stop her. Now, her uncle, Teardrop, who is played by John Hawks, who also was nominated for an Academy Award for Best Supporting Actor for the role, is also involved in the drug trade, is also involved with the redneck mafia.
It's like a family business.
Yeah, kind of. And is, you know, also warning her to not stick her nose in where it doesn't belong. But after an incident occurs, he decides he's going to help her in his own way. It is a story about a very screwed up family in a very screwed up community that is on top of which there is poverty and drug abuse and a lack of education and all the rest of it. It is a painful and devastating look at this part of the world, or at least a sliver of this part of the world. And it is, as I said, a movie that got Jennifer Lawrence her first Academy Award nomination.
At age 20.
At age 20. She was 19 when she made the movie, playing a 17-year-old. And according to IMDb, the people who made the movie didn't want to cast her. They said she was too pretty, that people wouldn't believe her as this backwoods redneck. She went to New York. She walked 13 blocks through the sleet and had not washed her hair in a week. And she went in to audition. And she got the part because she was willing to go to that length
to not be pretty.
To knock her pretty down. I'm not sure Jennifer Lawrence could not be pretty.
Well, true, but she was willing to sacrifice image in order to play a really meaty, substantial, perhaps once-in-a-lifetime kind of role for her.
Right. And, of course, she's also gone on to be nominated for other Academy Awards.
Well, and she won for Best Supporting, I think, for Silver Linings Playbook.
Yes.
Yes. So she is...
Was that Supporting or Best Actress?
I think Supporting. Okay. But I'll have to look in a minute. Or you can look either or. But yes, Silver Linings Playbook.
Yeah, I knew she won for that. I just didn't know if it was...
I think it was Best Supporting Actress. I know it's when she tripped on her dress walking up to the stage.
So, well, it doesn't matter.
Anyway. Carry on.
I didn't see this movie in the theaters, but I did see it streaming. And this isn't the kind of movie I normally go to, I choose to watch. I really much prefer things that aren't quite as emotionally challenging as this, because it is a bleak and dark film.
It's heavy.
I think I was a little more involved in who was going to win the Academy Awards at the time. So decided that I would watch this film to see if she had a chance. And it was like, this movie is a revelation. She's terrific in it. The movie is fantastic. And it's just it's just this effort by this young woman to, despite everything thrown in her way, to protect her family, despite what everybody else in her family and her community is trying to keep her from discovering, or, you know, they're afraid she's going to rat them out to the cops. But all she wants to do, she doesn't care... You know, she doesn't care about anything other than either finding her dad and turning him in, or proving he's dead.
Just so that she and her disabled mama and her defenseless younger siblings aren't thrown out to the wolves.
Exactly.
Because while their home is squalor, mm-hmm. it is still a roof over their heads, and she still is able to, like, feed the kids... you know, make sure that they get some of their education, even though it's apparent that she's had to quit school in order to take care of her family. We see a couple of different references to her wanting to join the military, and part of it is just for, $40,000.
Yeah, cash bonus for signing up.
But it's not. That wouldn't happen soon enough, and she's only 17.
And she wouldn't be able to take her little brother and sister with her.
Yeah, so that's turns out to be a big fat no.
Yeah. Oh, by the way, again on IMDb, that recruiter was a real Army recruiter.
Oh, wow. That's cool.
And for that scene, she asked him questions... that and he responded. I mean, it was not scripted. The questions and answers, you know, it was like he was actually talking to a recruit, not that it was a hidden camera thing. He knew what he was, you know, that he was filming a scene for a movie. But that's why he's a little stiff. But
That's cool, though. I did not know that.
Yeah, he was talking to her like she was actually a recruit.
Yeah.
So, the little sister.
Yeah.
Several people in the movie, from extras to pivotal roles are locals. They're not actors.
Yeah.
The little sister, Ree's little sister, is just a local kid.
Oh, wow.
And actually, the house of the exteriors that we see when they're, you know, outside jumping on that trampoline.
Yeah.
That's her house.
Oh, wow.
I mean, they shot it in the area where the movie was set. And they used local people to give it the feel.
I think that those bluegrass musicians must have been local people.
Oh, yeah, I'm sure they were.
Yeah. This movie, I had no idea, you know, what I knew that I had heard the title Winter's Bone. I knew that it was based on a book. Didn't know anything else about it. And you, Stan, gave me a couple of choices. You said, I've narrowed it down to two things, basically. Are you in the mood for deep and dark, or are you in the mood for lighthearted and happy? And I'm like, let's go with deep and dark. And you're like, okay. And deep and dark it was. Deep, dark, and brilliant. And I know that brilliant is a descriptor that I use a lot, but sometimes, you know, the right word is just what it is. And this was a brilliant film.
Mm-hmm.
Move it over one mountain range into Appalachia, and you have, you know, you have a lot of the kind of material and subject matter that was covered in, you know, novels like Demon Copperhead, for example. It's just the way that the film is shot, it's like the colors are very muted.
Yeah.
Everything is very sort of gray.
Yeah. Hence the name Winter's Bone.
It takes place.
It's all supposed to be in winter.
Yeah.
It's all supposed to be very cold. The gray tint, I'm sure they put gray filters over the lenses. it's supposed to add to the bleakness of it.
You can almost feel the cold.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's like when I saw Nightmare Alley in black and white.
Yeah.
You could feel the cold and the damp and just the desperation of some of the scenes in that movie in black and white.
The starkness, yeah.
And the same here with it being just everything's got a little gray tint to it.
Yeah.
And that's, of course, by choice.
That's why cinematography gets Academy Awards.
Mm-hmm.
That being said, there were some shots of outdoors, landscapes, that were, even in their muted color palette, so gorgeous. Just the composition of the shot, you know, there were shots of mountains and trees that were just glorious. Even with that muted sort of almost grayscale color palette, there's a lot to this film that's really remarkable. The performances, also, we are from East Tennessee. We live in Knoxville, Tennessee, which is, you know, home of the First Church of the Volunteer. But Dale Dickey is a Knoxville person. She went to the University of Tennessee, and she won an Independent Spirit Award for her performance as Marib in this film. She has made sort of a name for herself primarily as a character actor. She's got one of those faces that is craggy and angular and lined, and without speaking a word, it's the kind of face that can tell a thousand different stories.
It looks pained. It looks like she's seen some bad stuff.
Yeah. Her face has miles on it.
Yeah.
And that's a good thing when you're an actor. She has, you know, made her stock and trade in character roles and independent, you know, small films and that kind of thing. But she's an East Tennessee export, and we're proud of her here. And her role in this film is not huge, but it's important.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. She's in like 3-4 scenes.
Yeah, not a lot of screen time for Dale Dickey.
But I mean, and they're brief, but they're all very pivotal moments in the film.
Especially the last.
Yeah.
Suffice to say, they're in a boat, it's cold, gross things happen. Mm. But ultimately, it's the last piece of plot that buys us some redemption.
Yeah.
So, won't go any further than that, even though it is a 14-year-old film.
True.
But I hadn't seen it. So, other people, I'm willing to venture a guess, have not seen it either.
Yeah, it's
and I think they should.
It's currently streaming on Max, but it's also got a tag on it that says leaving soon.
Oh.
So,
hit it and get it.
Yeah, you'd have to rent it or buy it on one of the other platforms. But, I mean, it could be going someplace else.
For free,
yeah.
Maybe.
Anything's
possible.
It is. But, yeah, it's certainly worth the investment if you want to you know, buy or rent.
Yeah, I wouldn't mind, you know, I would say it's even worth purchase.
Yeah.
To have it in your library just because it's one of those films that's going to hold up over time. It's not going to be dated as far as, like, technology or fashion or anything like that, because as Jesus said, you will always have the poor with you.
Mm-hmm.
And the look of poverty and squalor and desperation and misery permeates this film from start to finish. And what is with the nicknames?
Yeah, all of Teardrop and
Thump
and yeah, everybody in this movie's got a nickname that comes from, you know, just their life experience.
How does one get the nickname Thump? That's a story.
I guess. Well, you remember? I don't know if they were doing it when you were in high school, but you know. They would like try to hit you in the middle of the back, so you know, with the flat of their hand, so that it would thump. It would make a thumping noise. It thumped you good, or you know, say stupid stuff like that.
I don't know. Maybe, who the heck you hung out with in high school. I remember pounces.
Yeah.
And stout punches.
Well.
And sprangs.
It was tangentially related to that.
Okay,
but,
like a distant cousin of the pounce and sprang and stout punch?
Yeah.
Okay.
But maybe he got beat
thumped
up
somebody.
And he got thumped. You know, I don't know.
I don't know. He looked and seemed more like a thumper than a thumpy because he had
it.
Money.
Well, maybe. I don't know.
Well, I mean, he was the one who was at the cattle auction and
oh, the guy wearing the vest?
The old guy, yeah.
Oh,
that
okay.
Was Thump.
That was Thump?
Yeah.
All right. Well,
and he was not to be messed with.
No, he was not.
He was like a...
He was the boss.
He was like an Ozarks redneck family don. Or capo, as it were.
Yeah. He was not who you wanted to make mad.
No.
There were... several people who talked about how they did not want to get on his bad side. One girl said, "He's my grandpa, and I don't ever want to get, you know, don't ever want to get on his bad side."
Yeah.
He was not somebody. He's the one who gives orders of who you know, lives and dies or
gets beat up
or negotiates, you know, what tribute, for instance, might be in exchange for snot, you know, rubbing somebody out or something like that. By the way, that actor's name is Ronnie Hall. He was billed in the film as Ron Stray Dog Hall, so I'm not sure he's an actor exactly.
Classy.
He may just be one yet another local. But yeah, it's quite a movie, it has kind of a happy ending. Kinda.
We have the potential for redemption of a sort.
Yeah.
Stan is flummoxed.
Well, yeah, because I don't want to spoil anything, but it's the kind of ending that is to a degree satisfying, yet our family is still left in poverty, and still in this region of the country that is just inundated with drugs and you know, things don't, and the future for Ree's little brother and sister doesn't look that much brighter unless they are somehow able to get out. So I guess we're supposed to take that little glimmer and hope it grows into a flame, but I don't know.
Well, we have a reprieve for now.
For now, yes.
For now. And what happens after now
is anybody's guess.
Of course, I want to read the book now. I always want to read the book.
Well, and apparently there is a whole lot more backstory to the characters.
Well, yeah.
And
they can do that in books.
And some of the tensions that we see in the film are explained in these backstories. So, yeah, I'm sure as I have learned by reading The Shining, I'm sure the book is far better than the movie.
Well, maybe not better, but more.
More satisfying, perhaps.
Or just more information.
Well, certainly more information. But, yeah. What rating do you give Winter's Bone?
11D Skin Squirrels. By the way,
something Jennifer Lawrence actually had to learn how to do.
Yes, and this film obviously is not for kids.
No.
There's a little bit of language, there's violence, there is the skinning of the squirrel and the digging the fingers in and the pulling the guts out,
yes,
which is not something necessarily that everybody wants to see.
Right.
And
apparently that was a real squirrel that was being skinned.
So that whole no animals were harmed in the making of this film couldn't really, you know.
Well, I didn't
see
that.
Maybe it was dead already.
I didn't see that
at the end
of the movie. So,
of course, I don't think that they always feel the need to put that disclaimer.
Well, usually anytime there are any animals on set at a film,
they stick that on there?
Well, if there is a representative from the ASPCA on set to supervise the treatment of the animals, that not every film that has animals
has that,
has a representative of the ASPCA on set. So, and I guess since they were gonna actually have some, you know, squirrel skinning, I guess they didn't bother to have anybody from the ASPCA on set because they were gonna have to do that.
We also see Ree teaching her 12-year-old little brother how to shoot a double barrel shotgun.
Well, he doesn't shoot the shotgun. He only shoots the rifle.
The squirrel gun. But while she does give them, you know, good counsel, never put your finger on the trigger until you're ready to actually shoot at your target. Never, ever point a gun at each other. And, you know, be careful. Just the fact that, you know, kids and firearms, yeah, that would be upsetting or offensive or triggering to some people, which I grew up in East Tennessee. My dad was a sportsman and a hunter. And yeah, so I ain't got a problem with, you know, hunting for food to survive.
Right. And these people, that's exactly what they were doing.
That's exactly what they were doing.
Because they were having, and granted, it's a movie, I know it's all pretend, but they were having to depend on their neighbors to give them food. They never asked. Their neighbors just offered because they knew what kind of situation they were in. But their neighbors had shot a deer,
yeah,
and had dressed a deer, and they had some venison and they had some vegetables, and they brought it over without being asked. And you know, but also the little girl is shown shooting, helping Ree shoot the rifle. Ree puts her finger on the trigger, and while Ree is aiming and holding the rifle, she and the little girl both shoot to shoot the squirrel. You don't see the squirrel being shot. You just see them bringing home four or five squirrels, and then you see them dressing one of the squirrels.
So, that's
a little warning for you there.
11 skin squirrels from me. What is your rating?
Well, 5 stars. It is a beautifully devastating film. It's just a whole culture of which I have no knowledge nor want any more than I got from this film. And thankfully, I have not lived that kind of life, and hope to never.
Knocking on wood.
Yeah. So, you know, just. But it is a terrific movie, if anyone's curious, Winter's Bone is a saying that talks about someone who is tenacious, like a dog searching, digging for a winner's bone, you know, because Ree is, you know, trying to find out what happened to her dad,
yeah,
or find her dad, and she won't give up, like a dog looking for a winner's bone.
Well, so she's trying to survive, like a dog looking for a winner's bone.
Yeah, and that's where the name of the movie and the book comes from. What have you been reading, watching, listening to, all that good stuff?
Well, I've been on a bit of a reading jag. I have finished, since last week, I started and completed, a middle grade reader classic called Wonder by R.J. Palacio. It was made into a major motion picture. It is the story told from the perspectives of several different members of Augie's universe. The main protagonist is a young boy, fifth grade boy named Augie, August. He was born with like a one in a gazillion conglomeration of genetic anomalies, which gave him a very altered face. Now, in the book, we are exposed to the word deformed and how his family hates the word deformed, but people who don't know August and meet him for the first time, that would be a description that they would use. And we, the first part of the book is August's first portion telling the beginning of his story, and he said, I won't describe, you know, in detail what I look like, but whatever you're imagining, it's worse. But he is a not typical looking kid. And up until the fourth grade, his mother has homeschooled him. Now, he has a sister who's 4 years ahead of him. Her name is Olivia, but in the family, she's just referred to affectionately as Via. We hear from her over the course of this story and her perspective, what it's like to be the big sister of the kid who is referred to as the freak or the alien or the monster, and how this environment and this, you know, being in this family affects her. In the fifth grade, Augie's mother primarily first decides that it's time for him to go to school. Now, Augie is not a special needs kid. He just looks different. Mm-hmm. Intellectually, he's fine. You know, mobility-wise, he's fine. He is actually very, very smart. He just looks different mm-hmm. because his face is not typical. Mm-hmm. So his mom decides that it's time for him to go to school. And his dad is not really sure that this is the time to do this, or, you know, if there will ever be the right time to send Augie out to school. And he refers to it as, you know, sending out a lamb to the slaughter. And Augie doesn't immediately understand what that expression means. Over the course of the rest of the book, he gets it. Mm-hmm. But he is admitted to a prestigious school, and reluctantly agrees that, well, you know, as long as I can quit, if I decide that I want to quit, I'll give it a try. So he goes, and, you know, the first little period of time is kind of rocky for him. He makes some friends, or does he really? It's, you know, and being in the fifth grade at the beginning of middle school is tough anyway, even if you don't have challenges based upon your appearance, right? So some of the things that we see him experience are normal middle school kinds of things and would be happening to him to a lesser degree even without his facial challenges. But we hear from him, we hear from his sister, we hear from some of the people who are also in his universe. But it's become something of a kid's classic, and I understand why now that I've read it. And at some point, you know, I might like to see the movie. We might do it on a, you know, as a podcast topic at some point. But it's Wonder by R.J. Palacio. Really, really good read. And I recommend it, and I look forward to reading more in the Augie universe, because there are other books based upon this, you know, group of characters. Currently, I am more than halfway through a murder mystery novel called Saving Emma, written by Alan Eskins, and I'm just going to give you a little bit of synopsis from the book jacket. When attorney Bodie Sandin first receives the case of Elijah Matthews, he's sure there's really not much he can do. Elijah, who believes himself to be a prophet, has been locked up in a psych hospital for the past 4 years, being convicted of murdering the pastor of a local megachurch. But as a law professor working for the Innocence Project, Bodie reluctantly agrees to look into Elijah's case. When he does, he is surprised to find threads that lead back to the death of his, Bodie's, colleague and friend, Ben Pruitt, who was shot to death 4 years earlier in Bodie's home. Ben's daughter, Emma, has lived with Bodie and Bodie's wife, Dee, ever since then. They were assigned her guardians. They were her godparents. Now, at age 14, Emma has been growing distant and soon makes a fateful choice, taking her far away from the safety of her godparents. Now desperate to bring Emma home and to free an innocent man, Bodhi has to do everything he can to look into Elijah's case and to save the family that he has deeply come to love. This has been a quick-moving and very intriguing read. I started it today, and I'm over halfway through, and I'm looking forward to finishing, and I'll keep you posted, because, you know, by next week I should be way done, and, you know, I'm hoping for a satisfactory conclusion, and so we'll see. So that's kind of what's going on. Still plowing my way through my Lenten journey with the Pilgrim's Progress. And, you know, watching the same stuff that I've been watching basically with Stan. So that's it for me.
Okay. Well, you and I watched The Price of Glee on Discovery Plus. Now, this has been out for a while, so yeah. It's not new. But
Ugh.
Yeah, three of the cast members of Glee have died. The three of the original cast members. One of them died during this show, Corey Monteith. Two of the others died after the show was off the air. But what you probably hadn't heard was some of the staff and crew of the show, the technical people, also died over the course of making Glee.
Yeah, it's like, was there a Glee curse?
Some by their own hand, some by natural causes. Apparently that show was incredibly stressful and difficult to make on every level, from the cast to the technical crew, all the way down the line. The stress of it all was simply, at least in the opinion of some of the people talked to in these three episodes, was just too much. For instance, Corey Monteith, who had had substance abuse issues prior to Glee and had gotten clean, those had cropped up again during his time late in his run on Glee. And he was in the process of getting clean again and was on a trip to his to Canada, where he was from, and started using again, and apparently OD'd on heroin in a hotel room. And then, you know, the two other cast members, I can't remember the one boy's name.
Mark Salling,
who after the show, a girlfriend found child pornography on his computer, and he was arrested, tried, and convicted. No, wait. He was arrested and pled guilty to possession of child pornography, and then before he went to prison, he killed himself. And then Naya Rivera was on a pontoon boat with her toddler son and either jumped in to save her son, and the son was found on the pontoon boat, or something, and or jumped in with him to swim with him, and then got him back on the boat, but then she went under and she drowned. It's weird to have three primary, you know, actors on a show, even though two of them passed after the show's run. But still, it's odd that three should, from the same show, especially three younger people, should die, you know, so young. And plus, there were all of these support crew and other people who helped to make the show who also died during the production. It's a interesting show, and especially when they talk to Naya Rivera's father. They spend a lot of time on Corey Monteith. He gets the bulk of the interviews with his friends. Really, I was far more interested within talking to Naya Rivera's father, and how, she was a very talented singer from a very young age, and, getting on Glee, I guess like a lot of young actors thought that, they'd come knocking down her door to offer her parts in movies and TV shows after she left Glee, and the phone didn't ring.
Yeah, it didn't happen.
It was not easy for her. So, it's an interesting and sort of sad look at a show that, for especially many people who were, artsy kids and people on the LGBTQ plus spectrum, that was groundbreaking for them, that, shined a light on the sort of their side of the high school experience. And it's just sad that something that brought a lot of joy to so many people also brought a lot of misery to the people who were making the show.
Yeah.
They just simply did not have the opportunity, the people making the show didn't have the opportunity to enjoy the success of it because they were so busy making the show. And the kids were going on tours between seasons. They never had any time off.
Yeah, when normal casts and crew have hiatus, they toured and were running themselves ragged.
They never had the opportunity to take advantage of their fame by doing outside projects like movies, because some of them were offered films between seasons and they couldn't do it because they were obligated to the Glee concerts. So it's kind of sad that they just couldn't enjoy their fame during the show. So anyway, it's called The Price of Glee. It's on Discovery Plus. I watched a couple of documentaries on Canopy. One is A Message to the Stars, which is a message, the effort to contact intelligent civilizations that may be on orbiting planets of other stars by trying to figure out a message to send to them that they would understand, which is a very difficult thing. It's similar to trying to figure out how to communicate with an aunt, not your mother's sister, but the insect. There may be things that you can do to like train them to follow a sugar trail, but that's not really communication. That's just modification of behavior. There are very smart people who are trying to figure out how are we going to communicate with any intelligent civilizations that might be out there, if there are any, within communication range. And of course, the distances make that very, very difficult, because even at the speed of light, the closest star is 4 light years away, which means it takes 4 years to get a signal out there, 4 years to get a signal back. So a hi and a hello back takes 8 years. So, how do you communicate? How do you let people, and apparently mathematics is the quickest way to at least establish communication. But there are also those who say, well, maybe we don't want to talk to alien civilizations. Maybe they want to come here and take us over. But the arguments against that are pretty common sense if you think about it for a minute. So anyway, that was pretty interesting. It may be available on other services, but it's called A Message to the Stars. Another one on Canopy was Luminous. This is about an astronomer named Larry Molnar. Larry Molnar noticed a pattern with a particular star discovered by an undergraduate that it looked like it was getting brighter and dimmer at a fairly regular pace, but over the course of time, that pace seemed to be speeding up, and they discovered it was a binary star, two stars orbiting each other, one bigger than the other. And based on the speeds at which, based on how fast the orbit was speeding up, he was predicting that within the next 3 to 5 years, these two stars would merge and produce a red nova. Now, these things happen maybe every 100 years or so in our galaxy, but they usually are only seen after the fact. No one had predicted one. And so he and his team were doing a lot of research trying to figure out exactly how, just to cross all their T's and dot all their I's to make sure they had all their information. Now, during the course of this documentary, which is about 90 minutes, they also took a deep dive into Larry Molnar, who is a fascinating guy. He's this astronomer, and I guess that also involves some level of physics, but he's also a pianist at his church. He's deeply involved with his faith, which, you know, you don't see a lot in scientists at this level.
Usually it's either or.
Right.
And he's both. And.
And on top of that, he's not just interested in his field. He actually lost a job, a previous job, because he was trying to help his community not suffer a devastating flood like it suffered in 1993. And the chairman of his department said, you need to focus more on your job and not pay any attention to this, this other thing that's not in your field. And he didn't get tenure. He essentially lost his job. And it turned out he was right, because they did suffer another devastating flood 15 years after the flood that he was studying, because of the reasons he said that they would. And if they had listened to them, they might have been able to change things enough to reduce the damage.
Yeah.
So he's really a fascinating guy. And It's a really interesting documentary, not just because of the science, but also because of the person doing the science. So it's called Luminous. If you have a library card, you can subscribe to Canopy and have access to that and a whole lot more. Movies and documentaries and TV series and stuff, and it's all free.
And audiobooks and books that you can download and read on your devices. It's good to have a library card.
Yes, it is. And we finally, they finally released the final episodes of Death and Other Details on Hulu. It is we've talked about it before, so I'm not going to get into the plot or anything, but it's a very twisty mystery that if you think you have it figured out, you don't.
Twisty and satisfying.
Yes. And yet, at the very end, they set up a season two, so not maybe as satisfying as you might want it to be. But it is, it's a lot of fun.
It was good.
It's, it's got some nudity and some vulgarity and
sexual content.
Yes, yeah, some sexual
language.
Content. Mandy Patinkin is is really, really good in it. And it's just a lot of fun all the way through. There, while there are some rather, you know, repulsive characters throughout the show, there are also some really interesting and fun characters too. So it's really quite entertaining. It's called Death and Other Details, and it is available to stream on Hulu.
It's a Hulu original.
Yes. Anything else from you?
No. Next week is my turn. I have no idea.
Well, as always, we'll all be surprised by your selection.
Woohoo!
So, thank you very much for joining us on this edition of Comedy Tragedy Marriage. We appreciate it. Please subscribe, rate, review on the podcast app of your choice. But if you do it on Spotify, it helps us out a lot. If you would be so kind to share us with your friends on your social medias, that would be absolutely fabulous. If you have a question for us, you can send that to us via email or by leaving us a voice message. If you have a suggestion for us for something to watch, please tell us what that is and why you think we should watch it. Send that to comedytragedymarriage@gmail.com. You can also leave us a voice message by clicking the link in the description of this episode. I'm Stan the Movie Man. That's Maude the Movie Broad. Love you.
Love you.
And until next time.
Later.